Evolutionary Developmental Biology, or EvoDevo, is the study of the development of organisms to determine what it can tell us about how they've evolved and continue to evolve. Today's guest, Dr. Sean B. Carroll, is one of the rock stars of the field. Work from his lab has crossed over into the popular press to be featured in Time, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, Discovery, and Natural History. Dr. Carroll will be in town in May to speak at the University of Minnesota at the commencement ceremony for the College of Biological Sciences, but we were too excited to talk to him about his new book, Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for Origins of Species, to wait. Joining us to interview Dr. Carroll this morning is Minneapolis artist Lynn Fellman. Sean and Lynn, welcome to Atheists Talk.
Thanks, Stephanie. Hi, Dr. Carroll.
Hi.
Thanks for being here today. You've been doing a lot of traveling, so I bet you're really glad to be back home and back at the lab.
I am glad to be back, but I am off again today. So Darwin mania continues for the rest of 2009.
Oh, boy, I bet it's been wild. I'd like to say a little bit about you in the book before I ask a question, okay?
Sure.
Okay. You're a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, member of the National Academy of Sciences. Remarkable Creatures, the book. It's a terrific read. I recommend that everyone buy it. Buy it for yourselves. Read it to your kids. It's really easy to spot on the shelf. It's got a great 19th century look to the cover. It's about the history and development of evolutionary biology, and you tell it through the discoveries by intrepid scientists. Some of my favorites were the current explorers who use DNA to understand evolution and human ancestry, and some of those folks were the Leakeys, Neil Shubin, Pabo, but I know I'm getting ahead of the story. So why don't you start with the 19th century adventurers and the golden age of biology? Take it away.
Well, and thank you for those kind comments about the book. My goal in the book was to bring to life these people who had revealed so much about the history of life. And that all started with some explorers whose names are not so familiar to us. For example, Alexander von Humboldt, who undertook a voyage right at the end of the 1700s, the first few years of the 1800s, through South America and Central America. Now, Humboldt was a polymath, and he was pretty familiar with all that was known in geology and botany and zoology and astronomy and also in all sorts of other fields. And as he went through South and Central America, he measured everything, collected everything he could, made detailed observations of the heavens. He made detailed descriptions of the pre-Columbian ruins and evidence that he saw. He made detailed observations on the people that he encountered. And he wound up this trip sort of on a, I'll call it a lark, but after several years of traipsing through some pretty primitive conditions and rough terrain, he had decided to visit the fledgling United States, and he wanted to meet Thomas Jefferson.
Uh-huh, I like that part of the book where you talk about that.
So sort of imagine this, that this is the era where explorers would be eagerly sought in the White House because they had information about parts of the world. They had firsthand information about parts of the world that were critical to, you know, new countries or empires, as it might be. And so Jefferson was eager to meet with von Humboldt. Von Humboldt, in a letter of introduction, said, I'm really anxious to speak to you about fossils.
Fossils, it's terrific, yeah.
So of all things, well, Jefferson was really keen on fossils. In fact, he wrote what was probably the first American paper on paleontology, describing what turns out to be a giant ground sloth. And he even set aside space in the White House for bones that were coming out of places like Big Bone Lick in Kentucky, mastodon bones and various Ice Age, what we now know to be Ice Age remnants. And when, for example, he was so interested in these fossils because he thought that they were evidence of great beasts that were still roaming the unexplored parts of the United States. And when he sent Lewis and Clark west, he told them to be on the lookout for, you know, giant lions and huge elephants and things like this. So when Humboldt met Jefferson, they talked about the fossils they had each found or each described, and all sorts of other topics that were critical strategic interest to the United States, because having just come from Central America, he had a lot of information that Jefferson wanted. And then Humboldt really modeled his writing after some of Jefferson's earlier writings. And these writings were his narratives on his travels, these 5 years of travels, and these became enormous volumes, multi-volume sets, and they became famous worldwide. So Humboldt, at one point in the early 1800s, was really one of the best-known people in the world.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit more about Jefferson's attitude, or belief, I should say, understanding of the world, thinking that some of those fossils that he was looking at were real live creatures that may have been out west. So what was the kind of thinking in the 19th century then about species at that point?
Well, Jefferson at the time thought that nothing went extinct. So he thought that essentially, in whatever the plan was that governed life, that plan would not allow for things to go extinct. He just couldn't imagine it. And Humboldt had a pretty similar attitude. So while Humboldt was studying lots of the sort of physical universe, mountains and oceans and rivers and things like that, he thought that the question of life was really sort of beyond science at the time. The question of, for example, of origins. So while as brilliant as Humboldt and Jefferson were, they really didn't see life as a question that was, open to further pursuit. They accepted a view of the world where really, nature sort of existed in harmony by some divine plan, and that they were just, revealing little snippets of what that plan was. So they had a completely different view of nature than the people who were going to follow. And one of the critical people that followed, Red Humboldt, was inspired to travel the world because of what he read in Humboldt's narrative, and that was young Charles Darwin.
And I loved how you explained then, you made that nice transition into Darwin and his adventure, and then also with Wallace and Bates, and those three sort of came on the heels of each other, and how, if I may say so, they left as collectors but came back as critical thinkers. But talk more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Darwin, obviously a lot has been said and written about Darwin. So the angle that that I took is, his voyage was really the central experience of his life. And at age 22, after sort of, meandering his way through undergraduate studies and intending to study another year to get his divinity degree. But Darwin had been a pretty accomplished naturalist through field studies and field training and his own hobby of collecting. And he was recommended for this voyage on the Beagle. And after a fair amount of parental persuading his father, he was able to finally take the voyage. But the critical thing to understand is that, Darwin, while he was an excellent collector as a student, both of things like insects, and he had learned things about geology and collecting of fossils, he was just 22 years old when he boarded the Beagle. And he held the same view that his mentors held about life. He thought pretty much believed in the literal word of the Bible, but he was, eager to see parts of the world, to explore the unknown, and to collect what he could collect. And so on this voyage, whenever the Beagle pulled into a port, off he would go, often inland, riding his horse, and sometimes accompanied by various people or local experts, local natives, and he'd start collecting. And he collected everything. And he collected, shells and bugs and plant samples and, rocks and things like this. And over the course of time, he really transformed himself from a mere collector who shipped all this stuff back to England for the experts to deal with, and started thinking about what he had seen and what he had found. And that transformation, as you said, was into becoming a scientist. And instead of just asking, what was out there in the world, he started thinking about, how did this come to be? What's the bigger picture here? And that led him to think that, contrary to the way he had been taught, that species were not specially created and immutable, but species changed by natural laws, much as, mountains rose and fell by natural laws, or the planets moved by natural laws. And this was revolutionary. This was a total break in thinking for all he had been raised in, and for, of course, the centuries preceding him. And this was heresy. So he had to keep it to himself for quite a while.
Oh, gosh. And it was so interesting to read about him as a young man and how he did make that transformation from someone who was observing very, very closely and collecting and then thinking about it deeply. And one thing we can talk about is how he really wrestled with disagreeing with his mentors. He had deep feelings about that. And then something else, too, that we can move into, I know you're anxious to talk about because you write about it so well, are Bates and Wallace, who, as young men, continue to do a lot of discoveries throughout their lifetime.
A couple of unsung heroes.
That's right. And could you talk about Darwin's conflict? He had a great respect for his mentors and his colleagues. Tell us a little bit about some of the thoughts he had on his new ideas and how did he talk to his colleagues about it.
Well, within 2 years of returning from his voyage, he was very clear that species changed, and he thought he understood at least part of that process, which was this competitive process he described, natural selection, where variants that had some slight advantage, whatever that might be in life, would eventually prevail, and that would lead to the changing of species. But he was only 29 years old by the time that had cemented in his brain, and he was just getting his professional feet underneath him. And he was well aware, I think, of the philosophical implications of what he was thinking. It was, you know, a 180-degree turn from the world that he had been raised in and that he knew was the prevailing thinking of current scientists and politicians and other members that were powerful in British society. So he was not going to disclose what he was going to say for some practical reasons, but also the people that had recommended him for the voyage, that had taught him field work, that had corresponded with him from the ship. When he was out on this voyage, you know, Darwin, when he signed up for it, he thought it was going to be a 2-year voyage, and about a year into it, he realized it was going to be much longer. And he'd write letters home, including to his mentor, Reverend John Henslow, and he said, you know, I know not how I will endure it. And Henslow would write back, you know, very encouraging letters, you know, oh, don't give up. I'm sure you'll always find something to keep your courage up. And so, you know, he had bonds with people, and he knew that these ideas he was having would threaten those bonds, if not break them outright.
That was one thing that was just wonderful to read in your book, is how real these people are, and the way that you told about, you know, their personal issues and got inside their heads. And then it was fun to read about their tenacity and how they just stuck it out. You really had a lot of fun with Wallace and Bates. You want to talk more about those two?
Sure. Well, I mean, you say in terms of, you know, sticking it out. I mean, when Darwin, I just want to mention one more thing about Darwin to appreciate it, that, you know, he never overcame seasickness. So it's one thing to say, well, I'll be, you know, a 2-year voyage spreads, extends into being a 5-year voyage, and he's away from home all that time, away from his loved ones. But, you know, in the course of that time, while never overcoming seasickness, you know, he has to round Cape Horn and sail the Strait of Magellan in the dead of winter. You know, he has to be a very physically vigorous person. He climbs the Andes. He witnesses an earthquake. He ventures inland among natives that are, you know, hostile to visitors. So it took a lot of physical endurance. It took a lot of discipline to undertake these voyages. And while Darwin's 5-year voyage is admirable enough, his experiences were topped by Alfred Wallace and Henry Walter Bates. So Wallace and Bates were friends. They became friends through the hobby of insect collecting. Now, they were younger than Darwin. So this is in the 1840s. Darwin completed his voyage in 1836.
Okay.
And they actually had the benefit of reading Darwin's account of his voyage called the Voyage of the Beagle. Well, Wallace and Bates got up this idea that they were going to go to the Amazon because they had pretty much exhausted collecting in England. They hated their day jobs. They wanted to go someplace more exciting and where the weather was better and where there was richer pickings. And so the scheme they hatched, because they had no money, was that they would voyage to the Amazon and then sell extra specimens back in England to collectors and to museums. And so they arrived in the Amazon in 1848, and after a year or so of collecting together, they split up. And Wallace went about 2,000 miles up the Amazon and up a tributary called the Rio Negro. And I'll just pick up with Wallace's story, focus on Wallace for a second. So after 4 years of collecting in the Amazon, and he, along the river, he deposited all sorts of crates of specimens that he was going to ship back to England. And he also collected a lot of live animals. He hoped to bring about 3 dozen animals back to the London Zoo. And so he had these animals with him that he was feeding every day, keeping in small cages and things like that. And he had all these specimens stored downriver. But by 1852, after 4 years of collecting, he was sick and worn down. Just the poor food, the tropical diseases, the physical exertion. He thought he really had better return, perhaps even just to save his own life.
Uh-huh.
And so he heads downriver with these animals and collects all these specimens and finds a ship headed back to England. And just as he's starting to think about getting back to England, where he might have 3 square meals a day and a comfortable bed every night, the captain comes to his cabin and says, "I'm afraid the ship's on fire. Come see what you think of it."
Oh, my gosh.
So Wallace, still sort of in a weakened state, follows the captain to the hold, and sure enough, it's smoldering. It could erupt any second. Wallace realizes he only has only minutes to get off the boat. He races back to his cabin, grabs a few shirts, some drawings he made of some Amazonian fish, runs for the lifelines, grabs the lifelines, and slides down into the water and climbs into the lifeboat. And from that lifeboat, he watches the ship burn and sink along with all of his specimens.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
So he's in, this is about 700 miles east of Bermuda. He's bobbing in a lifeboat, unsure if he'll even be rescued. And he's lost 4 years off work.
Oh, it just must have been devastating.
Yeah, he later in a letter he writes to a friend, he said, you know, he didn't have much time to sort of focus on his loss because he had to focus on survival. So it turns out the lifeboat's leaking and he's got to bail water out of it, and he's sunburnt and he's sprayed with sea spray all day, and they have only a little ration of water that, you know, they're having to share. But after 10 days he is finally rescued. And you would think after that whole ordeal, his loss, his near-death experience, that, you know, he'd give it up. But by the time he got back to England, he decided, nope, I'm not satisfied. I don't have anything to show for the jungles that I've explored. I'm going to go off again and make a collection, and I'm going to address this still open question of the origin of species. And so he went off to the Malay Archipelago and spent 8 more years island hopping through the Malay Archipelago, collecting in its jungles.
See, that's the most amazing part of Wallace, is that absolute devastation with his first travels and almost lost his life, and then he decides to go back out again.
He spends I think he makes 96 crossings in the Malay Archipelago, covers about 14,000 miles from Singapore to New Guinea, and collects about 120,000 specimens.
See, this is what I love about the way you write about science, and what's so great for all of us to read about it, to know that these people were extraordinary human beings in their character and their temperament, and they were great thinkers as well, because Wallace wrote very clearly about what he found as well, correct?
That's right. As he hopped from island to island in the Malay Archipelago, he had none of the inhibitions that Darwin felt. Darwin, you know, was sort of protecting his family name, his feelings about his mentors, and as it turns out, as the years unfolded, his feelings for his wife, who was a devout Christian, and her concerns about essentially their life in eternity if Darwin was to utter these heresies. But Wallace had none of those constraints. Wallace had left school at 13. He had no scientific reputation to defend. As he bounced from island to island, just as Darwin had made observations on the Galapagos Islands, how he found very closely related species on different islands, that's just what Wallace found in the Malay Archipelago. So he had very similar set of observations to Darwin. He just didn't have any of the constraints that Darwin felt about writing about them. So Wallace, in 1855, starts writing a series of papers that bit by bit are revealing this picture of the fact that species change, and that they change through this process that, while Wallace didn't call it natural selection, he came up with a pretty good description of it.
Okay, thank you. Well, one thing I really liked about your book is the way that you broke it into 3 sections. The first section is the development of the evolutionary theory. Then, as we move ahead and go through time here, the next section that you talk about is our fossils and how that became some of the real evidence to prove the theory. I loved how you talked about Eugène Dubois. Do you want to talk about him?
Sure. So, I mean, Darwin's Origin of Species really set the agenda for the next 150 years and hopefully much longer. And Darwin did not have a lot of fossil evidence in hand at the time of the Origin of Species. He would have loved to see what's unfolded in the last 150 years. And, of course, the question on most people's minds after The Origin of Species was they weren't going to worry too much about finches or butterflies. They were worried about humans. What was humans' place in nature? And the critical question was, well, were there links that linked humans to the rest of the animal kingdom, for example, to apes? And Eugene Dubois, who was a very accomplished physician, a rising star in Amsterdam, he had read a lot about evolution. He had read Darwin and Thomas Huxley and others as a younger man, and by the 1880s, he realized that, you know, one of the most important things that anyone could find was a link, a missing link between humans and apes, and he decided he was going to be the guy to do it. So figure this, he's well established now in Amsterdam, beginning a family, and he decides, well, no, I'm going to chuck all of this, find the missing link. He figures, well, where's my best chance of finding it? So he's sort of studying maps, and he decides it's going to be in Asia, and the best place he can go in Asia is the Dutch East Indies, because that's at least a Dutch colony, and he would be, he would have some facilities there. But the only way he can then make a living, so that had sort of as a hobby that he could, you know, look for fossils, is because he's a physician. He enlists in the Dutch Army, which is an 8-year commitment.
Oh, my gosh.
He comes home to his wife, you know, hey, honey, guess what I did today?
Oh, what did she say?
She actually went along with it.
Oh.
I guess, yeah, maybe it was the early stage of their marriage, and she was, you know, wide-eyed and devoted. But his wife and young baby and Eugene Dubois then went off to Sumatra, and he started, you know, working in the Army hospital while at the same time exploring for fossils. And it was several years. They actually then moved over to the island of Java because Eugene thought the pickings there might be a little better. And he first started looking in caves because that's where things like Neanderthal had been found. But then he moved to riverbeds. And after about 4 years, it was the help of a team of workers that the government eventually gave him, they found a molar and then a skull cap and then a thigh bone. And sure enough, this was what was known then as Java Man, but what we call today Homo erectus. Dubois pulled it off. One of the most, you know, single-minded expeditions I know of, but also one of the luckiest. This is like, you know, throwing a dart at the world map and actually finding something. You got to appreciate that in excavating fossils, that he was mostly, for year after year after year, finding bones of everything else that existed at the time. You're sort of looking for a little shard, you know, a little needle of hominid bone in a haystack full of other animal bones. And understand how fortunate Dubois was. Once he found these bones in Java, lots more people followed him to Asia, but no one found any more hominids for 40 years.
Oh, it's just amazing.
So he really pulled off quite a feat, and his determination was rewarded. It turns out when he got back to Europe, he wasn't heralded. He was greeted with a lot of skepticism, but we do recognize Dubois as finding one of the most important links soon after the birth of Darwin's theory.
What an eccentric person. And then in your book, that leads us into Roy Chapman, because he then went back and looked for, well, you tell it, please.
Yeah, so Roy Chapman Andrews is actually a Wisconsin boy. So he grew up not far from where I am, and down in Beloit, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And he wanted to work in a natural history museum. And to make his story short, while working at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, he decided to undertake a huge expedition into the Gobi Desert of Mongolia to search for hominids. And he sold this expedition on the idea of finding ancient humans. He sold it to J.P. Morgan and Chase and Rockefeller and other titans of New York banking and other industries. And they bankrolled him for this enormous expedition that was going to involve lots of experts from the American Museum, several vehicles, this is 1921, 22, fleets of camels that he would take out into the desert. And so off they went into the Gobi Desert in 1922, and over the course of 8 years, they didn't find a single hominid.
Oh my gosh, 8 years.
Whatsoever. But shortly into the expedition, they found dinosaurs by the ton. They found dinosaurs in places where they were just anywhere, which direction they turned, there were dinosaurs weathering out of the rocks.
Oh, boy.
And this is an expedition that found dinosaurs that might be familiar to Jurassic Park fans. They found Velociraptor, they found Oviraptor, and they discovered the first dinosaur eggs.
The first dinosaur eggs. Oh, that's
so that
great.
Made the connection that the dinosaurs were, in fact, egg-laying animals, and they found them in nests, which raised the possibility that they actually had nest behavior. Roy Chapman Andrews was quite a character. He always wore a ranger hat, always had a pistol at his belt, and that mattered because these were really wild lands, and he encountered lots of bandits and things that would sort of fire warning shots to scare them away. So this was quite an adventure, and Chapman Andrews had the skill for telling stories. So when he came back to the United States and the dinosaur eggs were a sensation. You know, he gave lectures everywhere. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He was in the newsreel, and he became quite famous. And reportedly, George Lucas, the filmmaker and the inventor of the character Indiana Jones, must have based some of Indiana Jones' character on Roy Chapman Andrews, the gunslinging explorer, who also, as coincidence with Indiana Jones, hated snakes. So I think that Roy Chapman Andrews is a fair description of what George Lucas had in mind when he wrote the character Indiana Jones.
And you've got a terrific picture in your book, too, of him with his, we won't call it a costume, because like you say, it was very necessary, hat and guns and things that he had about him. When you're talking about fossils and hominids, I love the stories that you told about Mary and Louis Leakey. Mary Leakey being, of course, a woman, so I'm reading that quite closely.
Sure. Well, unlike most people who thought, especially because of Dubois' findings and then later findings in the 1920s, that the cradle of mankind was Asia, Louis Leakey was convinced otherwise. He thought it was Africa, where he had actually grown up. He was the son of missionaries and grew up in Kenya. And he had found as a boy tools that he thought might belong to the Stone Age, just like the tools had been found in Europe and in Asia. And so he was convinced that there must have been older humans in Africa, and he was determined to find them. And he met Mary Leakey, who helped him illustrate one of his books, and they married, and they undertook essentially a lifelong exploration together of East Africa, living in the bush most of the time. Mary Leakey said she much preferred living in a tent to living in a house.
Oh, gosh.
She was quite a card. She never graduated from any school, but she was a phenomenal illustrator and an unbelievable archaeologist. She really developed the methods for thorough excavation of sites and the thorough documentation of everything in, for example, former sites of former human habitation. And they looked all over East Africa, and they found tens of thousands of tools. They found places like in Ologosali that is still currently a museum today, a massive hoard of tools, sort of a Stone Age tool factory. But year after year, they did not find any of the bones of the makers. So it was very strange to be finding bones that were butchered of various animals and to find the tools that did it, but not to find the bones of the people that made these tools. And after 31 years, yeah, I repeat that, 31 years.
I didn't realize
that. East Africa.
Oh, boy.
In 1959, 50 years ago this summer, Mary Leakey one morning found a skull. It turned out to be 1.75 million years old. She called him Dear Boy. We call him Australopithecus Boisei.
Okay.
And this was the first hominid skull found in East Africa. And it electrified the world. It also brought the Leakeys a lot more funding, a lot more help. And in short order, they found Homo erectus and Homo habilis in East Africa at Olduvai Gorge. And this rewrote the story of the origin of humans and swung attention fully back to Africa, where it belonged and where it stayed ever since. But they were rewarded after a tremendous amount of work. I think, Mary Leakey herself, who not only found Australopithecus Boisei, but it was 25, almost 20 years later that she found, I think, some of the most famous remnants of human activity, which were the footprints at Laetoli, nearby in Tanzania. So, and these were footprints made by a hominid about 3.2, 3.4 million years ago as they walked through freshly fallen ash from a nearby volcanic eruption. So over a span of about 50 years, she had a phenomenal series of discoveries, and she and Leakey really opened African paleontology.
And it's a wonderful way that you tell these stories about the people who are so tenacious and they stuck it out for so many years. I hope we'll have time, and hope you'll want to talk about Neil Shubin and the DNA revolution.
We received a question by email from Mike that ties right into that. Mike says, I'm in the midst of reading The Making of the Fittest. You open with the case of the Antarctic fish with antifreeze instead of hemoglobin in its blood. Who were the intrepid explorers to brave the cold and discover the bloodless fish of Bouvet Island?
The presence of antifreeze in southern waters fish was first discovered by Arthur DeVries, who's now at the University of Illinois, and has worked down in the Antarctic for about 40 years. But the bloodless ice fish were discovered first by people who were first sort of fishing in the southern waters, but first described by a Norwegian explorer named Johan Root, who confirmed that they, in fact, had no red blood cells. And that was 1954 that he reported that to the world. And there was a series of studies over the last 50 years or so that identified the genetic changes that had taken place in these fish over the course of their evolution. So these bloodless ice fish in the Antarctic, the only backboned animals on the planet that don't have red blood cells, are a marvelous illustration of how evolution doesn't always work sort of in a progressive way, that things get lost in time. And they've chucked a part of their genetic and biological information that had nurtured animals for more than 500 million years on the planet.
Thank you, Dr. Carroll. And you talk about Neil Shubin's work also in your book, and it's more about the tetrapods, where they make the transition from, is it water to land? I know there's quite a duration of time there, but go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, we spent a lot of time looking back here in time until Mike's question, at some of the earlier explorers. But the last impression I want to leave is that, you know, that spirit is gone, or that there's nothing left to explore. Darwin described the crust of the Earth as a vast museum, and we still only explored a small percentage of it. And some of the things that are there in the crust of the Earth are very important clues to major transitions on the planet. And just a few years ago, Neil Shubin and colleagues, Ferris Jenkins and Ted Deschler, ventured to the Arctic, and they, from geologic records, thought that this was going to be a good place, in particular Ellesmere Island, to look for creatures that would represent the transition from fish, fully aquatic animals, to the first animals that left the water and walked on land, the first four-legged vertebrates, what we call tetrapods. And after several seasons, and you got to realize the arduous circumstances of their explorations, they're having to get to Ellesmere Island is tough enough, then get out to these camps by helicopter. This is 24-hour daylight. Often the wind is ripping. It's polar bear country. And, of course, they don't know if they're going to find anything that's new. And for several seasons, they don't. And so after devoting 5 or 6 weeks every summer, they have a very narrow exploration season because of the weather that's there. Finally, in 2004, they strike pay dirt, and they find multiple specimens of a creature that's remarkably transitional in terms of it has a neck like land animals, not like a fish, but it has fins like a fish. So it has this mixture of characters, of both fish-like characters and tetrapod characters, and they dubbed it the fishapod. And its formal name is called Tiktaalik. And it's a terrific discovery of something that bridges the origin of tetrapods, the four-legged vertebrates, to their fish origins. And it was just reported in 2006. So there are plenty of scientists that are scouring the world right now, discovering new species in the Amazon, discovering new fossils in the Arctic, or new hominids in East Africa. And sort of the adventure that Humboldt and Darwin and Wallace and Bates all started 200 years ago is still healthy and going on today.
And that's what's really great about how you wrap up your book, is just that same feeling of excitement that you write about that is out there today, that scientists like yourself, Dr. Carroll, in your lab. Could we take a moment and just talk about that, where you're looking at the genetic components of the toolkit? And your current article in Nature from last month was very interesting about deep homology.
Well, sure. I mean, but I want to make it clear to everybody that I don't have an ounce of the courage that the people I write about have. I explore from the safe confines of my laboratory at the University of Wisconsin. But the things that we're finding and what we've been pursuing is the longstanding question of how does form evolve and where do new structures come from? And that's revealed a series of surprises, and probably the most profound surprise is that much of the genetic information for building all the variety of animals that exist in the world was in place a long time ago and has just been used in new ways. And for example, in the origin of limbs that evolved from fins, or the origin of, for example, the huge beetle horns that essentially evolved from nothing in beetles that fascinated Darwin, or the origin of eyes that have evolved many times in the animal kingdom, that we understand there's genetic ingredients that have been around for a long time and that for more than 500 million years, and it's the new uses of these old genetic ingredients that give us a lot of the new structures that we see in the animal kingdom.
Yes, and when I was reading this article that you share authorship with Neil Shubin, how the regulatory mechanisms are being understood and that the very ancient common ancestor had some of the basic components that have led to variety. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, you do. So that's a surprising thing. If you think of all the diversity of animal life, you'd think that there would be, you know, entirely different genetic ingredients for, you know, making a butterfly and a dinosaur or a human and an earthworm. But the shocking discovery started to unfold about 25 years ago that the genes for building our bodies, our tissues, our organs, are shared with most of the animal kingdom. So the same genes are involved in building our eyes that are involved in building bug eyes or planarial eyes. The same genes involved in building our heart are involved in building little tissues that move blood and fluids around the inside of a bug.
And I'm so interested in this and so sorry to interrupt you, but we're winding up our hour here, Dr. Carroll, and I would like to encourage people to get this book, Remarkable Creatures, that we've been talking about. But the last part you and I have been talking about, Dr. Carroll, is written in your book, Endless Forms Most Beautiful, and that's your area of evolutionary developmental biology. Thank you, Dr. Carroll.
Thank you, Lynn.